Welcome to At Work in America, sponsored by Paychex. At Work in America digs in behind the headlines and trends to the stories of real people making a difference in the world of work. And now, here are your hosts, Steve Bowes and Trish Steed.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the At Work in America show. My name's Steve Bowes. I'm joined by Trish Steed. Trish, how are you?
I'm good, Steve. How are you today?
I am well. And Trish, we have a fantastic show today, kind of a different show. Brian Wempen will join us to talk about mental health, addiction, overcoming addiction. He's written three different books on the subject, including one that's just come out in January. So we're going to get into that stuff with Brian. It's a great conversation. Brian's super interesting guy. And really deep conversation coming up.
Yeah, and it's such a good resource. So I encourage everyone, please listen, but also share this, because so many people are dealing with different addictions of all types. And not only is the book a good resource, but the conversation with Brian is as well.
Yeah, it really is. So before we welcome Brian, let's thank our friends at Paychex, of course. This episode of At Work in America is sponsored by Paychex, one of the leading providers of HR, payroll, retirement, and insurance solutions for businesses of all sizes. Trish, 2024 is going to be a great and amazing year for HR tech. AI and automation can finally offer significant time savings on daily HR management tasks, transform things like hiring and reporting and managing the workforce. But you might be wondering, where do I even begin with selecting and upgrading my HR tech? Well, Trish, we, meaning you and me, have worked together with our friends at Paychex and nine more of our HR friends to assemble a comprehensive guide to HR tech in 2024. It features insights to help people assess, shop for, and onboard new software that can save you time, resources, and money. With so many new technologies hitting the market and what's quickly becoming an AI-obsessed work culture, it might be hard to find the starting point. This toolkit is the first step in cutting through all that noise. So if you're ready to streamline your processes, save time, make strategic investments in HR tech this year, don't wait another minute. You can get your free copy today of our new guide at paychex.com/AWIA. That's paychex.com/AWIA, and start your journey towards fixing those legacy processes and embracing the new era of HR tech. So thanks to our Paychex. This is a great report too, by the way. So go check that out. Please do. The link is in the show notes. And with that said, Trish, let's get on to the show and welcome Brian. We are excited to welcome our guest today, Brian Wempen. Brian is an accomplished author and passionate storyteller based in Santa Fe, New Mexico. That's a lovely part of the world. His journey began with Note to Self, a collection of 99 life lessons in 2015, followed by Sober is Better, My Note to Self in 2019. Drawing from his experiences with addiction, adoption, and mental health, Brian explores often overlooked themes like adventure, healing, and self-exploration. His latest book, I don't even know how to say this exactly, My Demons is coming out in 2024. It is a fearless exploration of these topics, redefining normalcy along the way. Brian, welcome to the show. How are you?
Oh, good. It's so great to, you know, one, see both of your faces and hear your voices, and absolutely spend a little bit of time talking about the book and getting caught up and, you know, the world in general, if we encroach on that. And you're right. Everybody should go to Santa Fe and try it out. It is a beautiful, you know, it's a beautiful place. I feel very, a lot of gratitude every time I get to come back here when I've been traveling. I really enjoy rolling up into high desert, and it's a wonderful, wonderful place.
You know, that's one of the few places I've not been. So I need to come for a visit, Brian, because I've always wanted to see Santa Fe and I just never have. So,
we would welcome you with open arms.
Good. Yeah, it's a beautiful part of the country, beautiful part of the world. And yeah, it's one of those places where you think, boy, it took me a long time to get to New Mexico. Like it was, I just happened to be passing through there and I'm like, wait a minute, this is like the prettiest place I've ever been. And so I was lucky enough to spend a couple of days there a few years ago. So great stuff. So Brian, great to see you. Listeners may not know that we had not sort of seen or talked to you in quite some time. We used to do a lot of stuff together back in the old days, right? With early days of HR Evolution, the old days of this podcast, your podcast. It's been a long time, but it's great to see you get caught up and also learn more about the latest book and maybe even some of the ideas in the first couple of books as well for folks who may not be familiar. So maybe let's start from there. Like, what are you up to these days? And then we'll get into some of the book stuff.
Sure. No. And again, I really appreciate the conversation and spending a little bit of time. And, I love what you all do. It was the inspiration of when I first did a podcast almost 15 years ago. You know, your podcast was the inspiration mm-hmm. for it. So it goes back a long time. It's about almost 9 years ago now. I segued out of anything HR related and got into healthcare. And just to do something kind of different challenge, you know, I knew that my time in HR had kind of run its course and I was just ready for something different and kind of jumped in there and learned kind of ground up the real basics to kind of moving into have kind of progressed over time to like, you know, working with like small providers and practices on the technology side and really progressing over the years into managing public health initiatives for states, inpatient hospitals, or specifically mental health and addiction recovery, and then kind of expanded that to community health and then more into tribal health. So I kind of have run a lot of the continuum around different wow. types of healthcare and the technology behind it. And so, 3 years ago, progressed into digital health because I thought, you know, that's kind of the way we're going, right? Access and equality, you know, the great equalizer. Once we get cell signal or, you know, bandwidth, like connectivity in places, you all of a sudden can correct a care desert, no matter where you are in the world, if you have one of those things with digital health. And I thought that's really the progression of where we're going, AI and some of the other really modern technologies. I'm like, I think I want to be there. And so I jumped into that about 3 years ago and was very successful and then took a role as chief revenue officer with a 2-year-old startup called Remble, who's now Remble Health, about 7 months ago. And I have not worked I will always work fairly hard, but I'm not this hard. You know, startup mode is very different, but it's awesome. I mean, it's an incredible opportunity to get people connected with getting help.
Okay.
Right. So that's ultimately what really drives the fact that we're building something that actually does help people. And so I'm super excited to be able to do that. So, that's kind of the professional side. And my wife and I moved to Santa Fe about 3.5 years ago during COVID. We actually built a house and moved all during COVID, not intentionally, but it just worked out that way. And so, kind of based out of here and travel all over the country for different things and still do a lot of that. And so, which is good. And so I crisscross occasionally with, some of the folks that we all know, not too much, unfortunately, but whenever I can.
Well, thank you for sharing all of that. It's interesting. We recently recorded with an executive from LinkedIn and we were talking about skills. And the one thing that strikes me is you're kind of talking about, you know, working in the human resource realm, and now you've sort of morphed that into healthcare more generally, and now even more specifically in some of those specialty areas of digital and tribal support. It really strikes me that that's truly what someone who looks at their skill set, and you can apply it in so many different areas, right? Because a lot of people, we were talking about how that people sometimes have a difficult time making a connection on how their skills might be very valuable, right, in another format, in another industry. And so I just want to at least acknowledge that you've actually, it sounds like, seamlessly done that, because the skills you had from your sort of life in HR And caring about people, and when you started talking about mental health, like to me, that's just such a natural progression. Did you think of it like that, or was it just something that sort of morphed over time?
Boy, I wish I could say that I had really pieced the puzzle together like that. Obviously, I really do truly enjoy supporting and helping people, supporting people in what they want to do and living a very fulfilled life. Or that's kind of core to my personal mission in life and for myself and the people around me. But I was literally, I had a very small startup, software startup that was HR centric around screening, and it was, made several mistakes, partly because I was kind of burned out on that part of that market or that sector, and really got to the point that I was, it was my company and I was really unhappy. And my wife actually pointed out one day, she's like, "You are miserable every day. And I can see it on your face, and you're still just trying. And maybe you just shut it down and go do something completely different." And I was at that point where I'm like, okay, like you're right. Like I can't continue to do this. I'm not going in the right direction. It doesn't feel good. I'm not motivated. Like I'm just kind of going through the motions because it's my own company. And so I had to let that go. And that was a very humbling exercise. It was very healthy because there's a lot to just admitting your failures, right? Calling it what it was and trying to figure out how do I never repeat that again? And so I kind of went from kind of running everything, and I just jumped in at kind of a sort of a kind of an entry level kind of inside role to start learning. I knew nothing about healthcare, completely healthcare illiterate. Just, I mean, 100%. Didn't know anything about insurance, never did the benefit side of thing, just really had no, I mean, technology, I understand technology, and there's, when it comes to clinical workflows, technology really has nothing to do with it. I learned that very quickly. It's not the technology stack, if that's still a term. It's truly clinical workflows and talking about outcomes and talking about efficiency and quality, and the continuum of care, right? And so that's where it all started. And I had some incredible mentors who were very patient. I mean, I worked hard, of course. And I was a big learner. Like I did for the first year, keep my mouth shut, didn't volunteer for anything, didn't take any, like I don't want any kind of any leadership role whatsoever in the team. I just want to do my job and make sure I learn as much as I can. And they had an then the environment was really set up to do that. And so I'm super grateful for how it started. And then, once kind of I was more fluent in what I was doing, things moved pretty quickly. Like I was able to kind of navigate. I like complex. I like big and complex and stuff that other people don't want to do. So I started working with states and public sector. And so those are big and complex. And so with, Medicaid populations and all those things and legislators and all that stuff. So it's been really fun, actually, and challenging because it's using a different part of my like skill set. And like you said, and I've been able to really kind of dig into that. And at the end of the day, we're helping people. Like it's the same. That's where the connection starts to come into play now that I've had a bit of time out of the industry. I kind of see where it does connect a lot more. And I've kind of decompressed from the experience. And so I always have the best. I just had a conversation with the HR, an HR director in a county who we're getting a lot of interest from for Rembl for employees because within the EAP, the two most underutilized area of the EAP are mental health services and substance use disorder services or addiction recovery. Because people are, it's the stigma. They don't want it to impact their, their work status or what people think about it, and they're sure it's going to get back. Whether that's true or not, the fear is real that they don't want to do anything with it because it'll get back to their supervisors or their company. So they're using our, they're putting setting our platform which is 24/7 non-clinical support through our digital solution right beside the EAP, so that they can anonymously and privately start to help themselves and get help without it being any notification back to the EAP and trackable. So there's a lot of interest. We just are getting a lot of interest around that, which is really interesting. So I connect with the HR managers like really, really, really well, which is kind of fun to have it converging all kind of all together there. So.
Yeah. Meanwhile, Brian, while you're making this significant professional change, learning a new industry, learning new processes, workflows, technologies, the actors at play, right, in a very complex industry. Meanwhile, you're all of a sudden became, I shouldn't say all of a sudden, but you've become now a three-time author and gone on your own personal kind of journey itself, right, and transformation and self-discovery and all that. And seems like a lot to do at the same time or within even that same chunk of 10, 12, 15 years. But let's talk a little bit about that side of it. Like, meanwhile, you're doing all this professionally, you're kind of healing, rediscovering. Maybe I'll let you explain it better about what's going on with you personally.
Yeah, it's, you know, there's, a, you know, it's, and thank you. It's a great question because it has been, and, you know, there's definitely some chapters and phases. So, So when I first met both of you, I was still actively, you know, using substances. And so, and there's not a whole ton of people that I can actually say that are on both sides of the equation, oddly enough. And so, you know, and that was 2009, kind of progressing into 2010. And so that's really where it all started, right? So I actually got Last Drink, you know, is in the book. It's, and Trish, I know you were there, but I'm not, and Steve, I can't remember if you were. It was in Chicago at one of the unconference
okay.
Things. And so but you know, was May 2010. Like I have a very specific, you know, timeline and framework around that. And so, and that's where it started, because at that point, then I started, once I got, you know, because kind of the thing is you remove, like from an addiction recovery standpoint, you remove the behavior, the negative behavior, or you remove the substance, which is your coping mechanism or part of a coping mechanism. And then once you remove that, then you really get into the good stuff and start unpacking all the reasons that you're using that coping skill, and you got to find new coping skills. And so, you know, it was interesting to do it in parallel, and, you know, just kind of, you know, it started down that path. And so once I got kind of into a few years of doing the work, and the thing about the always here in recovery is, you know, you just learn how to live life with more tools, because life doesn't continue, and good things and bad things are going to happen in life for everybody. That's the human experience. And so, and they don't happen typically on your timeline the way you want them. And it, maybe the things you want are not the things you need. And so I just kind of went down that path, and about 2013, you know, I've always wanted to write a book. I thought that would be awesome. It was, one of our long-term friends, William Tincup used to give me a really hard time because I was always talking about wanting to write a book or write books and do these things. And he had written one or been part of writing one. And so he kind of doesn't let me forget that, because I always was like, we got to write a book. He's like, I don't want to write an effing book. Like I've done that. You do it. Knock yourself out. And so I started writing the first one, you know, which was the, you know, 99 life lessons. And so I really wanted to start touching. I wasn't completely comfortable in telling my story from in the professional setting completely. So I eased into it, and I had to learn how to write a book, first of all. Mm-hmm. Like different ways to explore that, because I'm not a natural writer. I have to work extra hard on that. My lack of skills in that area, I think I skipped those classes years ago, and so I've had to kind of really work hard to figure that out and kind of just you know, learn, right? And so I started, and so that first one, you know, started writing that into 2013, and just kind of outline and stuff, and it progressed, wrote it through, you know, kind of played with it. And then 2014 got a little more serious about it, and in the summer, and then it got released in 2015, right? And it was kind of my first efforts. And so that one, you know, that one, it felt good, and I kind of understood that. And then it was interesting. So it was almost 4 years to the month, almost the day that I wrote the second one, first one was like a general, like just little bits and pieces. The second one was like my first 18 years, really, is what it talked about. And then just being in recovery was the second half of kind of the thesis of that. And then the last one that just came out in January, you know, I suppose I can say it. So, you know, fuck my demons. You know, it really was talking about, like, there's, you know, we're in a period of our world that I heard this saying, there's a pandemic of certainty where everybody knows they're right and somebody else is wrong. So we have such a divisive, you know, polite discourse is a very unusual thing, unfortunately, at the moment. It's really, there's just a lot of divisiveness. And so I just wanted to kind of talk about from my perspective, and I really wasn't going to write another book because I'm like, I've said enough. And then I finally, post-pandemic, and then just things going on, I decided, like, I've just got a little bit more to say that I just want to get out and get done and kind of talk about from 18 years to current day is what the next book is about. And you know, in navigating professional and personal, and, you know, in that time frame, you know, I've had divorce, had marriage, had loss, had change of careers, had, you know, there's a lot going on in there. And so a lot that everybody deals with, right? I'm not unique in saying that I have those things to deal with. And so, but yeah, so this one was, and it's interesting. I've tried writing them different ways, right? There's like writing books is, I really enjoy it. Like I'm working on two additional ones right now. One, my first fiction, which is very, very different. Like it uses such a different side of the brain and how you do it. So I'm learning that. I don't really understand it yet, but I'm playing with that. And then another nonfiction one that will come out next year. That doesn't have to do with me talking about myself in recovery. I can't do that. This is the last one that I'll write for a while on that. But it was a really enjoyable process because I took a lot longer to write it, and I just took my time and didn't put a, it's, I really did put a, it's got to be done then. And I listened to, luckily, my smarter half, and my wife was like, you know, who's putting the pressure on who here about your book? And I'm like, nobody. Like, I'm putting the pressure on me. And she's like, well, don't do that. See if you can stop doing that, and you might enjoy the process a little more. And she's right. I did. And I let it take more time and let it be a bit more organic in that cadence of doing that. And so, but I did, I wrote it a little bit differently. This one was different than the last two. I did use different techniques of like taking audio notes when I'm driving and then transcribing them. And I've did it every way you can think about it, writing every day. Like I've tried all these different types of techniques and trying to figure out what works. And so it was a fun process.
You know, I'm really excited that it's sort of the third and maybe final chapter of this particular series for now anyway. But what I like about it, Brian, is you mentioned we have known you for a very long time, and as you were even just describing your journey, I'm thinking back to the fact that I guess maybe this will sort of lead my question. When I met you, I had a very positive interaction with you. I found you very warm and great conversationalist, and just there was something really sincere about you. And that would have, like, looking back now, I know that would have been at the height of where you were maybe struggling and in this, addiction that you were really battling. But yet I formed such a wonderful opinion of you. And knowing you then that next year, right, as you were still kind of like getting to the point where you were going to have that last drink in Chicago. Fast forward, you were mentioning even you called it your failure, right, with your company. But yeah, I was a customer, and I can really say that the solution you gave my company at the time was absolutely so positive and monumentally changed the way that we were hiring for the good. So I guess my question in all of this is, for people that might be struggling with things, right? We all have struggles, but whether it's addiction or, I definitely think you don't have to have this specific type of addiction, right? It could be a gambling addiction, it could be a shopping addiction, it could be all sorts of food addiction, right? In reading your story, do you ever reflect back on the fact that it was still possible to make some really positive things happening, but maybe you just weren't able to see yourself in that light? I don't know. Does that ever come up as you're sort of writing through these thoughts and feelings? Because, like, to me, knowing now you had these challenges, it's horrible, right? But you were still a very positive light. And I just have to think other people are probably struggling similarly, right?
Yeah, no, and it's and I definitely appreciate the the kind words. I've always always had a we've been able to been in proximity and been able to spend different chapters together specifically. And so it's interesting. So just addiction, and I'm glad you pointed out. So addiction is a very broad term, right? It doesn't have to be substances. It could be gambling, it could be gaming, it could be your mobile device, screen time, it could be shopping. There's a variety, there's an arc of what addiction falls under. And so I think what like for me, I was very lucky to have a foundational upbringing that was around being a good person. Right, like my mother was always about doing the next right thing, and it was super, nice and polite, and my dad kind of, battled his own stuff, but at the end of the day, he was about helping people, and he was always, and I've reflected on this, since he passed away, and especially in the last year or two when I was finishing up the book, he was never, ever, ever disrespectful to my mother at her expense, right? They used to argue because he was because of undiagnosed PTSD, which I after he passed, I actually kind of figured out that was always the problem from Vietnam. Like they would, he was volatile in that sense and had a really, 0 to 100 temper. And things like that, but he never at her expense ever, made a joke or was disrespectful. So I had a really good foundation around what that looked like, and I think that's helped me my entire life, right? To not be that person. The complexity of, and this is kind of to get to your question, is what happens is addiction, forces you into having all these different masks, right? So, you can like there's people that navigate, they go from, they go from doctor, CEO, lawyer to literally homeless. Nobody talks to them because they rode that the whole way, you know, down, and just, it hasn't clicked to what help, where help fits into that yet. And then you have other people who are holding it together on the facade and are doing the other parts and are just, you know, just cringeworthy, miserable and hopeless. And, you know, thinking about all the, you know, just swimming in that shame and guilt cycle of what the facade is causing, right? Like there's no one size fits all. And I, you know, and it's amazing because I, you know, it, and it's, it ends up being a mix. And toward the end, I think what was lucky for me is something clicked, right? Something clicked on the very last day, in the very last drink, the very last bar, and all those things. Something clicked where something's got to change, or I don't think I'm going to survive, and I don't want to hurt anybody, and I want to try and give this a shot. And so my willingness outpaced my misery and my hopelessness enough that I asked for help. Right. I called somebody that I knew was in recovery, that I had been, you know, we owned a company together in the past. You know, I called him and I'm like, man, I really do need some help. Like I'm kind of at the end of the line here. And I know it's going to get much, much worse because it was really escalating quickly. Mm-hmm. Where I didn't care. Right. I didn't care about the facade anymore. That's the fulcrum. Okay. When you cross over the not caring about the facade anymore, you are now like sitting on the launch pad of the space shuttle toward the end, like in some respect. And I luckily, again, you know, higher power, whatever it was, just said, you know, call and try and figure this out. Give it a shot. And so, and I, you know, that's really kind of how that started. But I was really good at the facade. Most people with some form of addiction, you know, that they're battling, or mental health, are really good at the facade, right? Which makes it even worse, right? Because you suit up with the armor of this is what it's going to be. And we all know people that you're like, oh my God, I would have had no idea. And that's part of the viciousness of the both mental health and, you know, addiction, is you get really good at that because it's part of your coping mechanism, is putting on the front, and then the front comes down and it is, you know, you're an emotional, you know, dumpster fire, and you don't know how to communicate that, or, you know, you're so embarrassed and you're in this cycle where you want it to get better, but you have, you know, you don't have a pathway to do that. So it just gets worse and worse and worse and worse until, you know, something happens. So,
well, I'm glad you circled back to that, because I think that's the point, right? It's that we all know people that are struggling that we are not aware of, or to the degree, right? And I think that's what really connects on this book, is that, wow, someone can really be going through it and you don't even know. You don't even know to offer and extend a hand of help or a resource, right? Steve, I know you wanted to ask some things specifically.
Yeah, I think, Brian, that was so fascinating. I was really, just really sort of taken by your story and your observations there. And one thing would really resonated to me is the idea of the facade, right? And once you stop caring, that sort of begins that, could begin, right, a spiral into some really, really poor, even worse outcomes. And I think the other thing I'd add, at least, and everyone's different, right? And everybody's experience in their life is different, including folks who have addiction issues, is I think many are really good at that facade, right? And then after a while, they stop being so good at it, but they don't realize it yet themselves, but the people around them are now realizing it, right? And that's when you certainly, and I'd say this is something I is definitely been something I've experienced too, where you were like, oh no, that's not me, or I'm fine, right? You're playing that game a little bit. And once people around you start to sense, not even sense, or they're finally able or tired of your antics and have to be honest with you, right? That tension starts to happen, because I think often the addict thinks they're still doing that functional part okay, right? They're showing up, they did go to work, they did go to school, they did, you know, take their kid to soccer practice, whatever it is you're doing, right, to be functional. And you think you're fooling people. Much, I guess I'll say it this way, the addict often thinks they're fooling people for much longer than they're actually fooling people, right? And that can be a really challenging thing to navigate. I don't know if, Brian, you felt like that happened to you at all in your journey or not, but I think that does happen a lot.
You know, I hear that. I just finished a book called Unaddiction, which it's MD that actually wrote it, and her depiction, because she really added more of the clinical framework, right? From literally, she was able to translate it, and she's such a good speaker. I've met her in person. And she's one of the co-founders of Eleanor Health. And anyway, she gives a really good, like, clinical parallel to putting it into, you know, just everyday terms, right? Like, here's kind of the deal. And, you know, she was talking about specifically kids, right? She's like, kids will see the addictive nature and the problem way before anybody admits that what's going on. Like, they're very perceptive. Mm-hmm. And because they don't have all the, you know, the societal, like, constructs that limit our perception, right? We rational, like, as adults, you learn to rationalize a whole bunch to get through your day in a way that's more like straight line from A to B, right? B to C. Like, that's part of just the way, kind of way we're wired. But she says, like, don't hesitate to talk to your children about it, because they already know. They just don't know what to do with it in a healthy way, right? Yeah. The information, but they already know. Like, they see things way more perceptively, because they don't have all the other stuff. Right. So their lens is very clear. Their filter is very direct and specific. And so I thought that was, you know, to Steve, to your kind of your comment, that's 100% the case, is when things, it works until it doesn't work. Right. Because at some point, like, I can remember, like, I was a daily drinker by the time I was 16.
Wow.
And nobody, like, no teachers, like, my peers knew it. But my teachers, my parents, I was very good at hiding that as my coping mechanism, and then just dealing with the, you know, the outlying issues that they came up, like I got caught or whatever, it was just dismissed. And I was really good at, like, it's a one-time thing, and, you know, I was whatever the excuse was. And so, you know, you get really good at, you know, rationalizing and positioning the truth, you know, aka lying about things. And but you get really good at that because you're protecting yourself, and it becomes part of your personality. And so when you get in recovery, there's a couple of things I just want to point out. Like, when you get in recovery, my automatic default, and I've been in recovery not quite 14 years, is I still have the gene where I don't want to completely tell, like, directly just address what's going on and tell the truth. Mm-hmm. Like, I have to put it, like, I go through I don't need to share all that, or I don't, you know, it's easier not to say that. And I just, my tools now kind of stop that. And I'm like, that doesn't really do me any good. So I just, like, here it is. And we just figure it out. And so it becomes part of your personality, right? It's one of your skill sets that is not positive. And so you take that into, like, you have to just rewire that muscle memory. And you don't really rewire it. You just have tools to manage your muscle memory a little bit better. in those situations. Like, you don't not tell the truth. You very quickly, you know, you make amends for something. If you like don't have a good day and you like, you know, lose it a little bit, and you go fix that right away because you don't want to carry around that baggage anymore. So you right the ship very quickly. And this is just the everyday living stuff, right? And you put things on the table and talk about it, because that way you're not carrying it yourself and it gets bigger than it deserves, right? There's a lot of things in life that are, they get way more space and energy than they deserve, because you're not, it's not being talked about, it's not being dealt with. And so I'm really, really big on that. The last thing I'll share is, again, it's, you know, mental health is a very complex scenario and topic in general. And I was almost three years into being sober and, you know, doing all the work and unpacking all the bags, as they say, and stuff. And I actually, the very first time that I had suicidal ideation was in sobriety. It wasn't, it was after the fact, and it scared the shit out of me. Like, I really, truly, like, I surprised myself, and I had to go, where did that come from? Like, it truly is one of those transcendent experiences that I had to be like, I don't really know where that came from. That really surprised me, that this thought popped into my head that was so, such a poignant and salient thought. It just was so weird. I remember it. And so, you know, I kind of freaked out a little bit, and I'm like, okay, well, I gotta figure out what's going on, because I don't know what's happening. And I'm like, you know, did I get enough sleep? What's going, you know, I literally started unpacking all the stuff, the checklist of like environmental stuff. And I'm like, I don't know what's going on. So I went and talked to, you know, my sponsor. I'm in AA 12 step, you know, it's kind of my path. And I went and talked to him, and he's very chill and very analytical. And he's like, look, and he's been sober for like 35 years. And he's like, you know, he goes, first of all, you're going to be fine. He goes, you're talking about it. You're telling somebody right away. You're acknowledging. So your awareness level is already dissipating whatever's going on. He goes, but, you know, bottom line is, you know, if you're not talking to, you know, a therapist, then that's a good subject to, you know, kind of connect with and talk on. He goes, but bottom line is, you know, we're talking about it. So it's not, you're not in this yourself, right? The aloneness is the part that everybody struggles with, because as your addiction rages and gets more complex, you get more and more alone. Mm-hmm. And whether it's true, you create that aloneness where your isolation becomes the killer, right? And I have known, you know, in the last 14 years, I can probably count on both hands the number of people that I know that didn't survive the disease. And were good, and then not good, and then good, and then not good. And ultimately, you know, they couldn't put the solution together, unfortunately, and very tragically. And so, but it's interesting, the complexities, because it's, you know, it's a mental health issue that you then start treating with whatever addictive behavior or substance you're using, right? So it's, once you unpack that, you got a lot more work to do, because you got to figure out what the mental health, you know, the behavioral health elements of what you're dealing with, whether it's depression, anxiety, untreated, you know, trauma. Like, I mean, that's really the pathology for all of this, right? It's trauma, anxiety, depression, and then everything else, kind of stress and substances and addictive behaviors. All of that is just a coping mechanism for everything else that's untreated, undiagnosed. And so, yeah. So
I'm thrilled that you mentioned that, Brian, because you're right. And I'm glad it kind of came to that. It's the addiction isn't the problem, right? That's what you're doing in response to a problem. But you're right. It's unpacking all of that. And one thing you said early on, I have a quick question about, is you use two words, right? You talked about the stigma of having addiction or mental health issues, right? And then also you talked just a moment ago about normalizing, being able to open up about that. What would you recommend, whether you're an HR, you know, leader listening to this or a practitioner listening to this, or whether you're someone who's struggling with an addiction of your own, right? Who's thinking about, I'm going to read this book. Like, how have you seen sort of hope enter the picture as someone who's now been sober for 14 years? How has this normalized, or is the stigma less in our society, or is that still really a huge problem for people?
Luckily, and it's a really, really big, good question, the good thing is we've made a little bit of headway, not a ton, because there's a lot of there's a lot of cultural issues, mm-hmm. a lot of class issues, there's a lot of economic issues, there's a lot of things that systemically people have to figure, like their misery pushes them through the stigma if it doesn't kill them, right? Like that's the reality of it, is there's, you know, we can talk about this all day long, but the reality is there's different professions that people will go to great lengths to not let anybody know they're struggling, because they know for a fact it will impact their career. Like their career path. And I don't care if you're an athlete, like, you know, say you're an athlete at a college and you're really struggling, then you're like, I don't want to tell anybody because they're not going to start me because they're going to think they can't rely on me and I got problems. Right. Yeah. And so it cuts across so many different areas that it's still a gigantic issue. We have to, you know, we just have to continue to normalize that this is, you know, you don't want to deal with it because it's like, not you, of course, but you as a society don't want to deal with it because it's difficult. It's not, you know, I can't put a Band-Aid on it and I can't control how to fix it. Right. So that ugliness of that, you know, the variability, people don't want to deal with it because it doesn't matter what community. It doesn't matter what level of income. It doesn't matter what, you know, what race or ethnicity or gender you are. It is everywhere. Like we've moved into an endemic mental health crisis in this country. And unfortunately, it is getting exponentially worse. Like the two highest areas of acuity are youth and seniors. They're basically, it usually stayed in the middle of the bell curve, right? Is really where the majority of it was. Now it's on both ends, right? Mm-hmm. So we just have this huge tsunami of just like across anxiety, depression, suicide, and, you know, addiction in many, many, you know, various forms that everybody's trying to sort this out. And it just, unfortunately, again, I don't see a time that it's getting better anytime soon, right? We're doing some incremental things and some states are doing better than others and some communities. But unfortunately, it is, you know, we have much bigger problems. And so, but yeah, so that's, again, people just don't want to deal with it because it's scary and you can't, it's not a quick fix. Right. And people don't, I mean, they just don't want to deal with like do the actual work. I mean, we could unpack from a performance review, workforce management, mm-hmm. we can unpack that. And it's and it's just a different form of, they don't actually want to deal with really what fixes the problem. Right. Mm-hmm. Like everybody's working off of a industrial revolution framework, and unfortunately, the healthcare world is kind of in that, like in the U.S., is working off of a hospital system framework, right? Where it's encounter based. Not to get too deep into this, but encounter based means you come in, there's a diagnosis, there's a fix, you get the fix, and then you go home and it works out and you move on with the rest of your life, right? Put a cast on it, put a Band-Aid on it, take this pill, in 2 weeks it'll all be better. Mental health and addiction, that doesn't work. And so you have that, you just can't reconcile. Like, doctors don't know what to do with it, right? The provider world doesn't know what to do with mental health and addiction. And so, you know, you have these huge gray areas that people just don't want to, they don't know how to fix. And so when you don't know how to do something, then you tend not to do anything. And that's the worst thing that we could do. So.
Yeah, Brian, it's such a important and complex topic, as you allude to here. And I think, you know, to get back to Trisha's point, the stigma around mental health, I think, is getting a little better, certainly in the workplace. I know just from our vantage point of the industry and the space over the last several years, the number of conversations we've had and providers that we've talked to, and just initiatives around helping folks in the workplace specifically manage their mental health better has improved. I think less so around some of these issues, Brian, be quite frank with you, around addiction and the fallout of addiction and what it means at work, what it means at home, what it means in our communities. And I hope that it's something, Trish, that we can maybe take on this year as we sort of head down into 2024, is look at that a little bit more, maybe here on this show and some other things that we're doing too. Because right now I do feel like it's individuals, brave people, quite frankly, like Brian and others like him, who are out there talking about these issues and being very forthcoming about his own experience and writing about them, right? And publishing about them. That's kind of driving the conversation, right? We're not seeing CEO of big company XYZ talking about this, right? I'm not. Maybe it's happening and I haven't seen it, but I don't think we're seeing it just yet.
Right. Well, I think too, though, Steve, I mean, you've got the right point. I think it's a little bit the push from the younger generation. They're more willing to openly talk about just their mental health needs from a very positive perspective too. So I'll tell you, like, I recently, I was someone who thought, like, you don't go to a therapist unless you're really troubled or something. Like, and I don't know why I had that stigma of, like, it would be bad to go. But I recently, just a few months ago, started seeking therapy. And it was after a mutual friend of ours, Lori Rudeman, actually encouraged me to do that. And I thought about it and I thought, you know what? I did. I started going for I was having horrible migraines. So pain management specifically was the thing. And what I've learned is it just helps all aspects of my life. And so again, whether you're not dealing with, whether it's things in your childhood or traumatic events, you mentioned PTSD could be a thing, whatever the thing is, we all have something we struggle with. Whether or not we admit it is one thing. If you do admit it, and I'm hoping that's what this show, if you've not reached out to read a book like this to begin your journey on your own, or if you've not reached out and sought therapy, gosh, Steve, I hope we can just take away some of that stigma, because you will experience help beyond belief and relief. And I've learned that, you know, my therapist even says everyone is depressed and anxious. It's just to different degrees. And so we are all using different mechanisms to hide from that, to mask that. We all want to show up and be our best selves at work, right? But you can't expect, Brian, you mentioned performance reviews. You can't expect to throw training at someone if their work performance is poor because they're struggling with something like this. Mm-hmm. Okay. Work training isn't going to cut it, right? So there has to be. And maybe we come back on another show, right, and have like more of a talk around the legislation, because I know that's part of it too. But there has to be other steps in place. You can't just throw sort of HR solutions at something when it's something we might not even be able to talk about in the workplace to help our employees.
No, and you know, I just one quick point, because I don't think I actually answered your question. When you start talking about, like, what are pathways to hope and relief, to figure out, like, when you're kind of wandering and figuring out, I know I feel bad and I don't know how to even begin trying to find a solution to help myself, right? Or you see somebody else that you kind of maybe think is doing that. you know, bottom line is start looking for people who are talking about it, right? Mm-hmm. And then you're going to just take that little step of faith to communicate. And I get messages. I love, especially within, like when, Rudiman's podcast came out, I got several messages from the HR world saying that we don't know each other, but I heard your show, like I heard your interview with Lori, and I just wanted to ask you a couple questions and share some things. And it really, like, that's the way that it should work, right? Like, you look for lived experience. If you don't have the means, or you just can't get yourself enough, kind of not confidence, but the willingness to go to talk to a therapist and get that scheduled, because sometimes there's a process that goes along with it. Your example was great. But if that's, find people with lived experience that from all intents and purposes, look like they might be somebody to talk to, right? Yeah. And the next thing I'm going to say probably sounds a little, weird to some, but bottom line is, if it's not always true, but just, I'm going to say it. If you're a female, reach out to a female, right? And if you're a male, reach out to a male, because it just takes out a variable that, I have learned over the years can be, you can't predict like this weirdness, right? You can't predict what you don't see and know from somebody. And this is really from the guy's perspective. Like, if a female reaches out, let's be honest, like if a female reaches out to a guy, that vulnerability has an element of, it's very intimate that you're sharing something that's so key to where you're at. That vulnerability has an element to it that you've got to protect yourself, right? And so I'm always super thankful, because I think I'm about as safe as it gets for people to reach out. So it doesn't matter. That's awesome. They don't have any worries there, but that's not always the case. And I hear those stories and it breaks my heart that somebody trusts like that and then somebody violates that trust, right? That breaks my heart and puts me in a little bit extra level of kind of just anger that somebody would take advantage of that. So it's just another thought, right? Yeah. Just to protect yourself, just keep that in mind that, especially if you might have trauma from your background, that's even more important not to exacerbate that trauma. Just think about that as you do things and just be very aware of that. That's all I would say.
I agree. All good points. I think you're right too. I think, whether it's a podcast like this or just, there people who have a platform of some sort, if they can share their own journeys, you'll help so many other people. You do help normalize it. So Brian, thank you for sharing your story for the last, I know it's come out and more over the last, more than a decade, but it really does. You've probably helped so many people you've never even known you've helped, honestly. So I appreciate it. I do hope there are more books coming, because I think that you're very perceptive and you're very just very sincere. It comes from a place of love, and I appreciate it. I've learned so much from you and your writings and your sharing.
Wow. I definitely appreciate the opportunity. Like I said, you all, we've been in each other's lives for a lot of years now. I was surprised when I started thinking about how far back that goes. And so,
yeah.
Awesome. Brian, this is Brian Wempen. The book is F My Demons. You know the word, F My Demons. It's out now. We'll put some links in the show notes where you can find it, as well as the other books as well. This has been so interesting, Brian, for me, and hopeful too, which I think is great. And it's a great story. And thank you so much for being so honest and open and brave and sharing not only in your books, but sharing here with us too. It's great to see you and really appreciate it.
Yeah. Good to see both of you. That's I was probably as most excited about that as anything. I always love talking about it because last thing is, I agree. The more people are talking about it, the more that people don't feel so alone and weird and strange and like there's something broken that can't be fixed. And we just have to continue to let people know that that's absolutely not the case, and just find that one pathway to try and get some help, and life can get maybe not less complex, but it sure can get better.
Yeah,
there's no doubt. So, and you all, this is a huge component of it, right? Your voice is really important. These conversations are really important for folks because every single one, there's something that comes through that is, you know, uber authentic, and something that people are like, oh my gosh, I didn't know that about that person, right? Yeah. And we're all just people. We might, levels of success are all over the board and titles, but your what you do is really, really important. And so I really appreciate that. Always 15-year fan.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Brian. Trish, great, great stuff. Thank you. You were the impetus for wanting to get this show on the books. I'm glad you did it. So thank you. We could probably do a whole nother hour with Brian. Maybe
we, I know, we should. Let's come back in like 6 months.
Well, later this year, but
let's do that. I follow.
I wrote down a bunch of notes. One last takeaway for me was, you don't have to carry it all yourself, Brian. You said that earlier in the conversation. Yeah. I wrote that down, and I'm taking that one with me too. So Brian Wempen, thank you so much. Trish, thank you. Thanks to our friends at Paychex, of course, for all their support. Remember, all the show archives, hrhappyhour.net. We will see you next time, and bye for now.